You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, has the Parkland school shooting changed anything?
You have an administration fighting to protect your Second Amendment, and we will protect your Second Amendment.
It didn't really sound like it if you were inside the NRA convention in Dallas this past weekend. The National Rifle Association has rebuffed the passage of congressional legislation to restrict access to guns. Today, we're looking at what's happening in state capitals, including our own. We'll talk with a state rep who is authoring two gun bills and an academic who studies gun legislation in different states. And as we begin, I'd like to hear from you. If you own a gun or not, did you expect more action nationally on guns after the Parkland shooting? And I mean legislation on both sides of this debate. Is the gun access or restriction issue something that will be a top priority for you as you vote in November? So as a gun owner, did you think there would be more legislation either opening additional access to guns or restricting access to guns after the Parkland shooting? Is the gun access or restriction issue something that is that you will prioritize as a voter in the primaries and in November? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. We're starting with Brian Bax. He covers the Capitol for NPR News, and he's been covering this issue. Brian, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Glad to be here.
Last week, you wrote about two Republican lawmakers who have come forward somewhat at the 11th hour with some gun bills. We're going to talk with Representative Sarah Anderson here in just a minute. Tell me a bit of the political context in which these bills will enter the debate.
Carrie, this year has seen more gun talk than in recent memory. A lot of talk about background checks, a lot of talks about taking guns from people who might be seen as a threat. But there hasn't been a lot of action. The main bills that have been the focus have stalled in committees. And so these bills come in well after committee deadlines, and they reach less far than the proposals from the advocates who want to see more gun control. But they will give these Republican lawmakers something to talk about at the doors, as, of course, the House is on the ballot in November. And there's a lot of pressure, particularly in these suburban districts, for people to act on these gun proposals after Parkland and after Las Vegas.
Who are those suburban voters that lawmakers may feel they have to respond to?
Well, there's a lot of moms and dads who are worried about their kids coming home and or not coming home if there's another one of these incidents in a school. We've seen a lot of school shootings, or, you know, large scale and small scale over the years. And it's resonating with people. I mean, there is a lot of talk about school safety, but not a lot of talk about gun safety.
And what do you account for that?
Well, the gun lobby is very powerful at the Capitol, and of course, the makeup of the House and the Senate with Republicans in control and a large rural bent to these caucuses, there's not a lot of incentive for them to defy their Second Amendment supporters.
This is one of the reasons that I'm asking about legislation to open up access to guns and also to restrict it, because we've seen that in the past, when there's a lot of attention on this issue, some state legislatures, including here in Minnesota, have moved to block anything that would restrict access and actually move legislation that opens up access. Have we seen that?
In the past years, the bills that have advanced through the legislature have been to open up access or to protect people who are gun owners if they're involved in a situation where they have to fire upon somebody on their property, or if they want to have a concealed permit mm-hmm. that's recognized in more than just Minnesota, or if a permit from outside Minnesota comes in. There are a lot of those issues that have gotten traction over the years, but anything that kind of curtails or seems to redefine the existing boundaries tends to stall out.
There's an ad campaign coming in from Every Town for Gun Safety. Tell us a little bit about the organization.
That's the group that's been funded by Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City. And this group has been kind of more active on the political front than some of these other gun organizations. There's Protect Minnesota, which has been the advocacy group trying to push the change and stay a little bit clear of the politics. Every town has tried to keep a foot in both camps. And we just learned about this ad campaign today, about ads that will be hitting tomorrow.
So we're going to listen to one of the, I think you said it's three.
There are three ads. One features a mother talking about what would happen if her child came home and had to talk about hiding in a closet because of a threat or an actual shooting. The other one features some students saying that they're fed up and they want to see change. And then I think the last one, which is you're going to play, features prominent voices in law enforcement and the Hennepin County prosecutor saying enough is enough.
Okay, let's listen.
It's my job to keep our community safe.
And I take that seriously. So I'm speaking out. There's a loophole in Minnesota law that makes it easy for criminals,
abusers, anyone to buy guns
with no background checks, no questions asked. We'll never stop all crimes.
But we can do more to prevent guns from getting into the wrong hands.
Background checks on all
gun sales.
It's just common sense.
Pretty interesting there. You said prominent law enforcement voices. We heard Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman there, Ramsey County Sheriff Jack Sarir, and Invergrove Heights Police Chief Paul Chanel. Who's the real target of an ad like that?
Well, it's those suburban voters. These ads will be airing on network and cable stations in the Twin Cities area. Of course, there'll be some spillover in outstate communities, but they're really aiming this at applying pressure to lawmakers in these districts where people might be talking about guns more than they have when they come to the door.
One of the things that you wrote about last week was this legislation from Representative Anderson and some of the co-authors comes within weeks of the end of the session. Now we're 2 weeks out, right, by the deadline?
And there's no sense that these bills will even get a hearing this year. And if they get a hearing, it's questionable as to whether they'll get a vote allowing them to proceed toward the governor for a signature. So they come quite late in the game. But if keep in mind, Sarah Anderson, who you're going to be speaking mm-hmm. with later, she comes from a district where Senator Paul Anderson, a Republican, sponsored some background check measures and some other things. And he took a ton of heat from pro-gun groups. So she's, you know, trying to dance carefully here, you know, by saying that she's seeking some solutions that she thinks will actually advance mm-hmm. or could advance and maybe do something to solve some of the problem, but not offending the gun groups that are so powerful in the state.
Brian, can you stay for a minute while
sure.
we bring in Representative Anderson? Representative Sarah Anderson is with us now. We were just talking about the fact that she's the chief author of two gun restriction bills, and she's with us from the Capitol. Representative, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. My ears are burning right now.
I appreciate the time. Does Brian have the assessment of the political context right, in your view?
Well, for me, I think when I look at this issue overall, we have a lot of laws in the books in Minnesota, and there's nothing more frustrating when the laws are not being followed. And that's what I find in this situation. So that's what my legislation attempts to address. We have these laws on the book. They should be followed because that's the real solution to these problems.
Just on the details here, one of your bills would incentivize but not require people who sell guns in private transactions to avail themselves of the background check. Am I using the right word? Is it incentivize?
It's definitely incentive, but they also have the motivation already in current law because if they don't do these checks and they sell to somebody that within that year commits a crime, a felony crime, they're liable for that. So they're on the hook. These folks already take this step. This is just an added incentive granting them immunity provided they do those extra checks.
And Brian?
Yeah, and this is the area that there's been a lot of discussion around is these private sales or transfers and whether those background checks are on par with what people would get if they walked into a gun shop.
Right.
So she is hitting on an area that's been part of the discussion, but the other side says, well, does it really force those type of background checks? And so that's where they're having an issue.
And Representative Anderson, is that why that you've crafted the bill the way you have, that it's not mandatory, but as you say, again, it's a way to urge people to do this because you don't think a mandatory measure would pass?
Well, these folks are on the hook if an individual commits a crime. So you can imagine you only get to, as a private seller, you only get to transfer guns three times a year. Anything beyond that, and you have to be a licensed dealer here in the state of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So for these folks, if they were to sell a gun to somebody that was not either eligible to have a gun in their possession, or they committed a crime with that gun, those folks then become liable for that. So they certainly want to make sure that they're checking the boxes so that they don't find themselves in court for simply selling a product to somebody else.
What are some of
this is a good incentive, I think, for folks to do that added measure.
Pardon me. What are some of your fellow lawmakers telling you about this? Again, we know that the deadline is just a couple weeks away. Brian was telling us that, you know, the idea is that this may come up again in the next session. Do you feel like some momentum is lost if we, you know, if we're months out from the debate over the next bills during the next session?
No, you know, the legislative process is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And so you need to think about giving people the information, giving them the time to digest it. On my other piece of legislation that really cracks down on the fact that we have a law in place that is not being followed and is allowing for domestic abusers to still retain their guns, that's a real problem. And so we need to, like, address that component. But it needs, you know, I didn't learn about that situation until March. So it takes some time to put these things together. It takes some time to educate members and the public about what this legislation does. But that doesn't mean we can't see some advancement on some of these things. It's just a matter of how much time we can spend here in the next 2 weeks to get some of these things addressed.
Representative, that's a fairly urgent issue, and I know the CARE 11's investigative report brought it to your attention about court orders that aren't being enforced to keep guns away from convicted domestic abusers. Given the urgency of that, could you not push hard to have some kind of debate and discussion about this in the last 2 weeks?
Yeah, you know, it's a glaring problem that we have in our system. And just to give you a couple of examples, Hennepin County had 598 cases that required gun transfers from domestic abusers, and only 11 affidavits were filed on that. So that's less than a 2% compliance rate. So that's a real problem. Hennepin County was no better. They had 304 cases and only 7 affidavits filed. So clearly we have a situation where we passed a law with bipartisan support back in 2014, and it's just flatly not being followed.
But I don't think you're answering my question, which is, you've just again talked about the urgency of this. Why not push hard to pass something?
Am. Oh, yeah, I definitely am. But it's also a matter of, we've got 2 weeks left in session. So it's educating members. I've sent out information to members of, here's what the bill does, here's what current law is, here's what the proposal is. And that just takes some time, unfortunately.
So. Okay. Representative Anderson, I know you have to go. I appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Anderson is a Minnesota State Representative. She represents District 44A. So, Brian, tell me about the politics of this and the questions that I asked about the urgency of this court order issue.
Well, the questions that have come up from law enforcement is who is the onus on in the Anderson bill? Sheriffs would have a lot of responsibility for actually enforcing those orders and going to court and proving within a few days if someone challenges that order. Mm-hmm. So they're worried about there being enough turnaround time to prove that so-and-so shouldn't be having a gun. But I want to say this, that even if there's not legislative action this year, the political intensity on this issue is through the roof, both sides. I mean, there will be big campaigns on both sides. You've seen it in the rallies that have shown up at the Capitol and the gun owners who have come out to the Capitol to push back on some of these bills. People are motivated, and the gun issue in either camp is going to be a motivating factor in this fall's election.
One of the things you asked just before I let you go was, is Representative Anderson responding to what you've just said, the political intensity around this, given the district that she represents? Is it enough to be seen to be introducing these bills to fend off some of that intensity from the other side?
Well, we see there's a ton of bills that get introduced at the Capitol. Not all of them are introduced because they will advance or people want them to advance necessarily. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that's the case here, but it does give those lawmakers something to say about seeking solutions to the gun problem if people feel like there's a gun problem. It depends on which doors they get to, and they want to be able to have an answer and say, here's what I'm pushing. What do you think about that?
Again, not that this isn't genuine, but you're also taking note of the political cover that might be provided here.
There are some up there who believe that there's a political cover aspect. I mean, I don't want to challenge her motivations, but that's just their argument. She's making the case that these are existing laws that need to be enhanced or further enforced.
Okay. Brian, thanks.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Brian Baxter is a political reporter for NPR News and spends a lot of time at the state capitol with me in the studio. I've asked you, and you're responding, and I think this is an indication of the intensity that Brian's talking about here. If you own a gun or not, did you expect more action nationally on the gun issue after the Parkland shooting? But I mostly want to know if the gun access or restriction issue is something that is going to be a top priority for you as a voter. 651-227-6000-800-242-2828 on Twitter at CarrieNPR to Richard in St. Peter. How's this work for you, Richard?
Yes, how are you doing? I don't know if it's going to be a primary factor in my voting. I mostly vote Democrat, but I am getting tired of the we have to do something, but the something is not really getting anything done. I do agree with that person you had on, that female that said that we need to enforce our existing laws. I really believe in that, but I don't believe that just making new laws just to make it seem like we're going to do something is actually getting anything done.
Okay. I really appreciate the call. To Lyle in Duluth. Hi, Lyle. How are you seeing the issue as a voter?
I think it's going to be, no matter what side you're on, Democrat, Republican, Independent, I think it's going to be definitely on voters' minds. I think after the Parkland shooting and the great job the kids have done down there, it's really brought it to the forefront. And I just want to make a point that when I was in the military, we shot fully automatic weapons. And there's the difference between a weapon and a gun. A gun is for fun, and a weapon is to neutralize the enemy or kill the enemy. So to think that the average person in this country should have a fully automatic weapon, I don't believe. I just don't believe in that. So
Lyle,
I think it's going to be on voters' minds.
Yeah. And on yours? Is that what I'm hearing?
Absolutely, 100%.
Okay. All right. I thanks for the call. To Ian in Mankato. Ian, as a gun owner and a voter, how are you thinking about this?
So it's not really a huge issue for me in deciding who I'm going to vote for, unless the extremity of the candidate is so far one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily, my frustration comes with a lack of any sort of compromise on the issue. So, like, I'm a liberal, so I totally support, you know, banning people who are on the no-fly list from buying guns, banning people who are domestic abusers from buying guns, establishing a waiting period. But at the same time, I also hold a concealed carry permit. So I'd like to see a concealed carry reciprocity expanded and reduction in civil liability for people who use guns in self-defense. And I don't see any of those ideas being paired together on any legislation. And it's very frustrating for me as a voter because, you know, I see a little bit of both sides.
This is excellent because I'm going to bring a political scientist in now, Ian, and talk to him about, as you've said, why there isn't some kind of blending of the agendas to get legislation passed. So thanks for the call. Robert Spitzer is with us. He's a professor of political science at Cornell University and author of Guns Across America, with us from Ithaca. And Robert, welcome back to the show. I talk to you frequently, and I'm really appreciative of the fact that you're available to us. Thank you.
It's good to be with you. Truth in Advertising, my primary affiliation is with SUNY Cortland, but I also have an affiliation with Cornell, and they're kind enough to let me use their facilities.
Okay, you're at Cornell today. What do you think about what our caller Ian said? And he's an interesting voter, isn't he? Somebody who's got a concealed carry permit, votes in a liberal way, but wants to see more blending of the agendas from each side.
Well, you're right. He's a very interesting individual, and I think he represents really a fairly large group of people in America who are gun owners, but who are not completely hard-line when it comes to anything regarding regulation. Because, frankly, the typical gun owner understands, the typical gun owner first is a responsible person who understands that firearms are dangerous, that you need to have a certain amount of skill, you need to treat them with care, and that they do not oppose sort of any and all regulations because people who misuse firearms, people who commit crimes with them, people who should not have them, only put a black eye on the people who are responsible with their guns. And frankly, in American law, in most states and at the national level, it's pretty clear that existing law has not done a very good job at more effectively getting at and restricting access to guns from those people who really shouldn't have them, which most people agree in terms of who they are. And making laws more effective, enforcement more effective is certainly important, as is enacting new laws that make clear what the standards are and how they should be implemented.
Yeah, I want to talk about enforcement in just a minute, but to talk about the politics for just a second, Congress seems to be a lost cause, basically, on pushing any legislation through. Is the action in state capitals on one side of this or the other, or maybe on a path that Ian talked about?
Well, at least a half a dozen states have enacted measures since the Parkland shooting to strengthen their gun laws. Most of those states are fairly liberal states. Obviously, Minnesota has been engaging in extensive debate about whether to change its gun laws. That debate's been happening in many states around the country. Interestingly, though, among the two states that have enacted stronger gun laws are two states that are traditionally very gun-friendly, that is Vermont and Florida.
Right.
And both of those states enacted significantly, politically significantly, and arguably legally significantly stronger laws, notable because nobody in those states can remember the last time those states enacted provisions to strengthen their gun laws.
So we know why Florida, that would have happened in Florida. What accounts for it in Vermont?
Well, Vermont is an interesting case because you think of Vermont as being a pretty liberal state. The northeastern states tend to lean pretty liberal. Vermont, after all, has a senator who is an avowed socialist. So
Bernie Sanders.
It's certainly exactly right, Senator Bernie Sanders. But Vermont also has a very long and strong gun rights tradition, and it has long had very limited gun laws. So this step by the Vermont legislature and signed into law by the Republican governor of Vermont last month, three laws actually to strengthen their gun provisions, was very significant, both in legal and policy terms. And I think it's an indication, A, that the issue is becoming more prominent in the bevy of issues that people think about when election time rolls around and when their elected officials come to see them and speak, but also in terms of the idea that the country, I think, has become impatient with the lack of action and increasingly affirming the belief that the government, state and federal, really should do something.
So that's what's interesting here for us is because and we heard Brian Baxter, our reporter, talking about this, the level of intensity on both sides. I think you and I have spoken before about the fact that the NRA, for its size, and there are larger advocacy organizations, is very good at motivating their believers, basically, to vote on this issue. And the other side of the discussion has not been very good at that. Do you see evidence that that's changing?
As you say, it is indeed quite true. And there is some evidence that things are changing. One evidence is public opinion polling, which indicates that a large percentage of Americans, a measurably large percentage of Americans who support stronger gun laws are also indicating that they are willing to vote based on the gun issue and their view of it. And that's one place where you would normally see the asymmetry,
right,
where gun rights people, even though they're a minority of people in America, very strongly single issue, being driven and guided by a gun rights agenda. But most Americans supporting stronger gun laws, yet for most Americans, the gun issue is of lesser concern. They're more concerned about the economy, about the price of gasoline, about lots of other things. But because of Parkland, because of the student effort, because of a sense perhaps that it's time for something to really happen, more Americans are indicating, at least right now, that they are going to vote on the gun issue. Now, will that hold true
exactly
when November rolls around? We'll see.
Okay. Joe says on Twitter, 90% of Minnesotans support routine background checks. I don't know where he's getting that, but this is what he's saying. But Sarah Anderson says, it takes time. I don't understand the delay. Legislators are choosing guns over the lives of school children. And then Jeff says, I'm voting against my state rep, Representative Linda Slocum, because her gun control bill was so onerous it made certain types of guns already in the hands of citizens illegal to buy and sell, and made it illegal to lend firearms to friends and family while hunting. So if you've just gotten in on the discussion here, we are talking about the intensity and the interest of gun legislation as a reaction to Parkland, what happened in Florida earlier this year on February 14th. What does that mean in a political context? What does it mean for you as a voter? To the phones here to Derek in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Derek. Yeah, appreciate you waiting.
Yeah, formerly Rochester, Minnesota. But I think one of the most frustrating aspects of this, and kudos to your Cornell professor. I'm a graduate there twice. But I find that it's very discouraging. I know there's dishonesty on both sides, but I truly feel as of late, the level of dishonesty on the gun control side is rather astounding. I mean, you know, constantly I get into these debates all the time, and people all say, well, we don't want to take guns away. We don't want to do this. We don't want to do that. And then yet, when you push them on the issue, it really turns down that most of the people advocating this, by far most of the people advocating this, particularly the leaders, really want to end up banning all semi-automatic weapons, which is, you know, they've been around for over 100 years. And I think when people have to be dishonest about what their goals are, you have to mistrust them. Secondly, the solutions, most of the time the quote solutions being proposed would never have stopped the thing that caused the problem. Arguably in Parkland, okay, raising the age to 21 might have. But usually with these shootings, there's a whole raft of proposals that wouldn't have even addressed the issue. And the other thing I wish the Cornell professor would acknowledge is that gun violence has declined significantly over the last 20 years. School shootings are actually less than they were 20 years ago. And one final thing, we constantly heard around Parkland that there were, quote, 18 school shootings, you know, up until February 14. You know how they classified school shootings? One guy accidentally discharged a gun in the glove compartment of his car.
Well, that was
while on a school.
Derek, that was a single incident, and I did look at the numbers for a previous show. So I think that was one single incident, and the numbers are mostly right. You've raised a lot of good points here. So Robert Spitzer is with us. He's a professor of political science at SUNY Cortland and author of Guns Across America. This is a good point, I think, Robert, to talk about the rhetoric and the dishonesty. I think what our caller talked about. I think he talked about the dishonesty on the gun control side. I hear it on both sides. I want to know how you hear it.
Well, there certainly is, I would say, very polarizing rhetoric. And Wayne LaPierre's comments, not just at their meeting last week, but generally when he gives public talks, he speaks in very apocalyptic and dark terms about what America is like right now, that we seem to be on the verge of kind of this apocalypse. This is indicative of the NRA rhetoric in its communications with its members and in its public utterances as well. And I think that kind of rhetoric leads the pack when it comes to polarizing and, I would say, in a broad sense, misleading talk. Certainly there are on the gun safety side, the gun control side, you know, they make their mistakes as well, although I would quibble with Derek to the extent that I know of no gun organization that wants to ban all semi-automatic weapons. The one category or subcategory of weapons that they're talking, that supporters talk about banning or restricting, are assault weapons, of course. And we had a federal assault weapons ban in place for 10 years on the national level back in the 1990s. I would also mention Derek's absolutely right in pointing out that crime generally in the United States has been declining, including violent crime, for roughly the last 25 or more years. And we often don't feel that way, but that's a very important thing to note. Although mass shootings do seem to be up in recent years, and that is a matter of concern. Final point about safety and guns. Schools, public schools, have witnessed these terrible shootings, like Parkland, of course, and they're horrifying. But we need to remind ourselves that, generally speaking, public schools are remarkably and extremely safe. There are over 50 million school children who go to public schools across America every year. And not counting this year, but in the previous 5 years, there have been fewer than 10 gun deaths per year in public schools all across America. So it's not zero, obviously. Schools are very concerned about safety. But, you know, we need to remind ourselves that society really is more safe than we sometimes think. That doesn't mean that policies shouldn't be changed, but we need to remember that.
And Robert, just one more note on that before we go back to calls. I suggested that when you look at gun deaths, often you will find an increase in the use of firearms in suicides. Is that correct? I believe we discussed that in our last show.
That is true. If you look at the number of gun deaths, we're up to around 36, 37 gun deaths total per year. And roughly, there are roughly twice as many gun suicides in America as there are gun homicides. That has been true every year. And indeed, the gun suicide rate has been creeping up. And that there's a number of very important studies about why that occurs and what could be done to interdict, to prevent that from happening. And there are strategies, and we know that there's a very high correlation between the general availability of guns and suicide, because guns make suicide extremely easy, and they lend themselves to the impulsive nature of suicide.
A call here from Harshad in Shoreview. Hey, thank you so much for waiting. I know it's been a while, but I'm glad you hung on. And tell me what you're thinking about. Hi, Harshad, are you there? Oh, might have lost it. To Ed in Brainerd. Hi, Ed. Thank you for waiting.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
A great discussion, and I speak from a perspective of I own a couple of guns. I will say that, and I have a permit to carry, and I do support a lot of the, I guess for lack of a better term, gun control measures being discussed, and I certainly I hear a lot of rhetoric coming from the NRA and certain kind of hardcore gun advocates that is extraordinarily misleading and frankly paranoid. Even the last caller, you know, if you're talking about banning semi-automatic weapons, you're talking about banning all guns, which really doesn't really track very well. And the boogeyman's out to get us and the black helicopters, and we won't be a free country if we don't have machine guns. And I just, you know, it doesn't really add up. I mean, you look at England and Canada, they're free societies, they're democracies. They have a lot fewer guns than we have, and the sky didn't fall in.
So, Ed, let me ask you this, though. You say you're a gun owner, you have a concealed carry permit,
Yeah. You
favor more restrictions on gun ownership. How front and center, I mean, honestly, is this going to be, are those views that you hold going to be as you decide who to vote for in the primaries and in November here?
I think they're, you know, they're becoming more so. They haven't always been the number one issue for me, but I think they're becoming more so. I mean, I agree that mass shootings are a small part of the picture, but we have a very high violent crime rate in this country compared to other relatively advanced countries, and I think and guns aren't the only reason for that, but they're certainly a big part of the picture. And not saying that every gun owner is a problem, every gun's a problem, but an easy access to some pretty heavy firepower, a lot, you know, people with major mental health issues. I work in the court system, pretty serious issues through the court when they're not supposed to have guns. It's very easy to get them. You can go to a gun show and basically buy anything, no questions asked. So I think there's a lot of things we can do to still allow gun ownership and not ban all guns, but just, you know, make it keep guns away from people who really shouldn't have them.
Okay, I'm really glad you mentioned that loophole at the gun sales, because Robert Spitzer, I don't know if you heard Representative Anderson talking to us about her bill, which would incentivize, not mandate, background checks, you know, in these gun loophole situations. Doesn't this exist in many, many states? Why has this been so difficult to address, given where voters seem to be today on this?
Well, it is one of those issues that has been discussed quite a bit. And indeed, in many states, it is very easy to make a private gun purchase at a gun show or in a parking lot outside a gun show or through other private means. And a few states have moved to tighten those regulations. I will compare, use the example of New York State, which instituted a provision in 2013 that said that if you want to make a private gun sale, any two individuals, with the exception of, sort of father to son or parent to child or immediate relatives, that you can make a private sale, but you need to fill out a form and you need to take that form to a licensed gun dealer who will then run a background check, and you pay a $10 fee to the gun dealer for the convenience of running the check, and it is required. So legislatively, that's pretty easy to do, and obviously there is a certain compliance question at stake, but if somebody
as
does
in how do we make sure that they're doing that?
Yeah, that's certainly right, but it's like other kinds of sales, like, for example, a private automobile sale where you do the same thing. You fill out a one-page form, you take it to the DMV, and the motor vehicles notes that the vehicle has passed from one owner to another. And I would add that the idea of doing this is not a new idea. There were laws in the early 1900s in some states that called for this very thing. As a matter of fact, the state of Montana had on its books such a law back 100 years ago.
Interesting, yeah. There's a number of states considering this red flag legislation, including in Massachusetts. And is there a person in the community with issues that raise red flags for law enforcement, and they can come in right on the front end and take away the weapons of that person? Do I have that essentially right or no?
Well, it's generally the way these laws have been written, it would normally be someone like a family member or somebody who knows the individual well, or the police so an individual, let's say, can go to the police or the police file a report on their own and go before a judge and say, and they can, confiscate the weapons if it's, for example, somebody who's a serial domestic abuser but maybe's not been convicted in a criminal court, can go before a judge. The judge can say, we're going to hold your weapons until we have a hearing to determine whether you should or should not have your guns returned to you. And there's a lot of support for these kinds of red flag laws, and there is mounting evidence that they are fairly useful to law enforcement to try and stem gun-related violence when it comes to people who indicate by their behavior and actions that they are disposed to violence.
That's interesting. I didn't know that there was research that says they can work.
As of a few months ago, there were, I believe, at least four states or five states that had such laws on the books. Huh. So they've had some practical experience with these measures.
Carrie in Robbinsdale says, I'm a gun owner, but I also grew up with domestic abuse. I wish there was a compromise, not so black and white. And we're hearing that from a number of listeners today. I think it's important to have a gun if you want it. Don't know why it's so easy for abusers to get guns. This will affect who I vote for. We need restrictions. Robert, a quick question about, you heard the other legislation here that we were discussing today is enforcing court orders against domestic abusers who maintain their weapons. It sounds like this is somewhat of a resources issue. It doesn't sound like this is legislation that will pass this year at the Minnesota State Capitol. Is that in effect in other states? How well do those laws work?
There are other states that have similar measures, and I can't speak to how the Minnesota statute actually is written. It could be that it's written in such a way that enforcement becomes more cumbersome or more complicated. So there may be a legislative solution that would be appropriate, or it could be purely an implementation or resource problem. And if it is, it would be addressed in a somewhat different way. But certainly there are states where it's fair, where there is much more discretion on the part of law enforcement to intercede in such circumstances.
Aaron says on Twitter, passing gun violence prevention legislation is my top issue. I will only vote for candidates who support common sense gun safety laws, such as criminal background checks and red flag protective orders. Can I ask you, Robert, if as our Capitol reporter indicated here, we're seeing high intensity on this issue on both sides, whether that is the case in some of these other states that you follow?
The answer seems to be yes, because it seems to be a national mood,
okay,
if you will, among the public at large. That is where the percentage of the general public saying the gun issue is a top-tier concern has increased significantly. And one of the truisms of public opinion in guns is that large majorities of Americans have favored stronger gun laws than what we have on the books for decades, literally going back to the end of the 1930s, which is when modern public opinion polling began. And even at that early time, questions were asked about how Americans feel concerning gun control.
Interesting.
And from that point to the present, with variations, most Americans favor stronger gun laws. And what we see post-Parkland is something of a spike in that number and a rise in intensity.
And again, we were asking, will this maintain through November? We'll see. To the calls to Ben in Princeton. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm just calling in to say that the gun control debate will impact my voting decision, but I think the one of the issues is that's not being discussed is it's bigger than gun control. Some of the bills that have been proposed or other suggestions have impacted due process rights, for instance, with the red warnings. I know one of the bills, and it's probably one of the more extreme bills, proposed having law enforcement come in and check firearms, which might be a Fourth Amendment issue with searching homes and those types of things. So I think, to me, the voting is more on a rights issue than just a gun rights issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it goes both ways. I know that there are some candidates who vehemently oppose gun control who are in favor of restricting other rights. And so it's not just a one-sided issue. It's a rights issue in general for our elected officials.
Yeah, yeah. I appreciate your explanation on that. Robert, tell me what you hear in Ben's thoughts on this.
Well, their due process concerns are always appropriate whenever the government is involved in enforcing laws. And I don't know the specific provision he was talking about regarding authorities coming to people's homes to check firearms. But I will note that historically in America, from the colonial period through the revolutionary period, through the enactment of the modern Constitution and into the early 1800s, the government routinely conducted gun censuses. You've heard of a census of population, but it's not well known that the government often and routinely, states basically, and the federal government in the early 1800s, conducted censuses of guns. How many guns did people own? What kinds of guns were they? Were they operable or not operable? So the idea of the government counting guns and knowing where they are also actually is a very old idea, although you can imagine today how people might react if some government official came knocking on their door with a clipboard asking them, how many guns do you own, what kinds, and are they operable?
You know, I'm interested in your view. We mentioned Florida earlier in the discussion, but I'm not sure. I think many Americans are aware that Governor Rick Scott, who's running for the Senate, I believe. Am I right on that, Robert?
Yes, he is.
Yeah. He signed these new laws that include, among other things, a waiting period to buy a gun. But he also signed a law that stops individual municipalities from passing gun laws. Not sure how many people are aware of that. So what does that tell you about how he's straddling this issue in Parkland, where, of course, or in Florida, where there's a lot of intensity?
Well, the bill that he signed indeed is, you might call it, a straddling sort of bill. It did include provisions like banning bump stocks and raising the purchase age for long guns to 21. But he also included what you described as a preemption measure, saying that localities cannot enact laws that are any stricter than the state standard. And that's been one way that the NRA has worked kind of quietly around the states in the last 30 years or so to try and restrict localities from enacting tougher laws. And the law also included a provision to allow teachers or other school officials under certain circumstances to have guns in schools. That was a provision supported by the NRA. But even so, given this total package, the local chapter of the NRA in Florida, headed by a woman named Marion Hammer, was extremely unhappy with Governor Scott, The problem is he's politically pretty secure. He's not going to be challenged from the right for the nomination for the U.S. Senate. And I'm not sure they can really do a lot to sort of go after him. But they've been, the NRA in Florida has been very unhappy with the fact that around 60 Florida state legislators supported gun measures when they had opposed them uniformly in the past. So it's kind of a shifting winds political moment.
Yeah. So what do you make of where the NRA is? Of course, they had their big convention. 70,000 people turned out for it in Dallas. But you've just told us that they're not delighted with some politicians in key states like Florida. How have they emerged from Parkland in early days here?
Well, I think the NRA has been on the defensive. Certainly, they have suffered something of a political black eye because they have been very sharply the focus of supporters of stronger gun laws who have been saying, look, this is the fault of the NRA. They are the people who have been standing in the way of states and the national government enacting stronger gun laws. We think they're the bad guys. And more public officials or people running for office have been willing to kind of say this publicly and use it as a political issue. So I think that has hurt the NRA's image, and it might be one explanation for why they tapped Oliver North, who they just announced yesterday to be their new president. And Oliver North, you know, known mostly for the Iran-Contra scandal, but he has been active with the gun community. He's served on the NRA board for many years. He's a conservative commentator on Fox News. And while North is not going to appeal to the public at large, I think the base of the NRA will be heartened by his elevation to become president. And I think it might be an indication that they're having a little trouble in raising money and getting new members to try and fight off the political challenges that seem to be rising against them.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. Ron in Rochester called to say the tactics of the NRA frighten members into thinking the passage of any gun legislation puts us on a slippery slope. There have been gun restrictions since the 1930s, and before that, Robert tells us, people need to understand there already is regulation of guns. It doesn't lead to onerous regulation. To Sophia in Owatonna. Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
What are you thinking about?
Well, this is okay. So I'm a transgendered person, and so this is coming from a slightly different perspective. But I am a firearm owner.
Mm-hmm.
I had to pass a background check for a permit to purchase mm-hmm. before I could get my carry conceal, which I also had to pass a background check for. And then I purchased both of my firearms through a chain called Cabela's, where each of those purchases required a background check. So I went through four separate background checks
wow.
to have the firearms I have.
Yeah.
Second, there was one other thing I wanted to talk about was that it's very sad, the school shootings and all the bad stuff that's been perpetrated. But there seems to be a pattern here where these very obviously criminally minded individuals are targeting places where they're, one, gun-free zones. Two, it seems a little cowardice to me. They're going after innocent people that can't defend themselves. We don't hear about these people walking into police stations or onto military bases or in any other place or venue where they could, you know, receive immediate consequences to their actions. And I think that speaks volumes to maybe in ways to handle this.
Hey, thanks for the call. Robert, do you see the pattern that Sophia sees in the targets that these shooters are choosing?
Well, I would get I would focus on the point raised about gun-free zones. There is no evidence of mass shooters who identified a target like a mall or a school or another place because it was a, quote, gun-free place. In the case of the Parkland shooting, which is pretty typical, the shooter targeted that school because he'd been a student at that school. And typically, there is some kind of association of that nature between a mass shooter and the place that the person goes to do the mass shooting. And indeed, most of America is gun-free. I mean, if you think functionally in terms of people's homes, in terms of where they go. So this notion that places that are gun-free are special targets, there's really no evidence to support that idea.
Robert, your insight is really valuable, as always. And I'm grateful that you make time for us. Thank you.
Oh, it's good to be with you and have the conversation.
Robert Spitzer is a professor of political science at SUNY Cortland. He's the author of Guns Across America, from Colleen on Twitter. If gun violence has declined, why does LaPierre continue to speak apocalyptically? Moreover, why do his followers not call him on it? You can keep the conversation going on Twitter. And if you missed parts of this show, you can find it on my iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, on iTunes or anywhere else.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828. Or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.